Thanks for the introduction, Tom. Because of the unique circumstances that we're in, I'm gonna try to make this talk as interactive as possible. So really think of it more as a discussion section. If you don't understand anything I'm saying, or if you have questions, or if you have a better idea than what I said, please feel free to let me know. I guess use that thing for social distancing. But other than that, yeah, thanks for having me. So today I'm gonna talk about, I think the title of the talk I gave was Hypergraph Theory and Quantum, I forget what I said, entropies, states, mechanics. I'll say entropies. This is based on several works, the most recent of which is the work with myself, Newton Chang, Sergio Hernandez Cuenca, and Vincent Su. And then the earlier work by me, Sepper, Hiroshi, Jamie, Bogdan, and Michael Walter. And then a recent follow-up work by Michael Walter and his student. But I'm gonna try to give a more broad overview of why we should care about this question. So because we're at a holography workshop, we're like contractually obligated to write down the Ryutaki-Anagi formula, where the entanglement entropy of some boundary region, which I'll call little a, is given by the area of the RT surface that's homologous to it in the bulk. Because the bulk is curved, it's not just the surface A itself like it would be in flat space. So this formula has led to, I would say, a lot of progress over the past 15 years now. But I want to emphasize a different aspect of this formula. So I want to think about this formula as a cut. So you guys are probably familiar with this notion from some of the work that Hedrick and friends have done in the BitThreads program, where there are two notions that I want to define: a flow and a cut. But in order to define these notions, first I have to define what a graph is. So a graph is a list of a set of vertices V and a set of edges E that connect those vertices. So an example of a graph, for example, with these vertices is maybe there's an edge here, an edge there, an edge there, and then maybe another edge like this, an edge like that. So this is a graph, right? So once we have a notion of a graph that's a set of vertices with a set of edges connecting them, we can ask about what cuts and flows. So a cut is just a partitioning of the set of vertices of your graph such that into two subsets, one of which is on one side canonically of the cut and the other is on the other side. For example, this is a cut that partitions this vertex from these other four. Right. The flow is, yeah.
How is it different from just, is it just a subset?
It's a subset,
some
but with
other property it has to have.
It's a subset, but with more information, right? So if I just gave you a set of only the vertices and I didn't give you any of the edge data, then I would say, okay, well, I separate vertex one from these other things, then that has strictly less information than the information associated with a cut, because the cut also knows the edge weights of the edges that it cut. So if you like, maybe the way in which the question that you're asking, in which the idea that you're formulating is correct, is it's kind of like a double partitioning. It's a partitioning of the vertices into two sets, but it's also a partitioning of the edges that are connecting them into two sets in like a dual way. Like, all I'm saying is this cut might be the correct cut, but it will have different information if these edges are all edge weight one, whereas if two of these are edge weight one and one of these is edge weight two. So each of these edges can have some number associated with them.
Okay, so far I thought you just defined a graph without mentioning numbers.
Yeah, I haven't gotten to that yet, but I can.
So the concept of partition depends on more than a graph?
No, the concept of partition doesn't depend on that. The part where that will become important is when I start talking about extremizing the partitions. So like you may have heard of like the min cut, max flow theorem. Things like that. When I'm talking about minimizing or maximizing those things, that's when the notion of these edge weights will start to become important. But the notion of a cut at the first level is just a partitioning of these things at the set theoretic level. It's just that you may have many potential choices for partitions, and then if you're trying to pick one of those, one way of doing it is with the edge weights, but I hadn't gotten there yet. So, may I continue? Okay. So a cut is, like I said, a partitioning of the vertices, or equivalently, a partitioning of the edges. A flow is, now we need to start thinking about these things as capacities. So imagine that the graph that you draw is some sort of network of water pipes, for example, and that each water pipe has a certain size associated with it that tells you how much flow you can put through the water pipe. So you would want to assign numbers associated with these. I might have a water pipe of diameter 1 here and a water pipe of diameter root 2 over there. Then the cross-sectional areas would say that, for example, if this is a water pipe of 1, then I can assign relative edge weights like this, where some of the pipes will allow more water through than some of the other pipes. So the flow between some set of vertices and some other set of vertices, it's just the maximum amount of stuff that I can send from one site to another site.
Should I think of this as a bound dimension, or am I getting to?
It's pretty far from there, so
okay.
I will eventually try to.
If you will get to it later, as an example, but it's a bound
dimension. Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I'll get to more familiar examples first, but I think that like. For this audience in particular, because this audience is much more familiar with the holographic side of things, I feel like very slow progress through the side that you're less familiar with is going to be important so that the connections are easier to make. Okay, so there's a notion of a cut, a notion of a flow. Now we can start asking about like notions of the min cut. So what is the min cut? The min cut is the cut of minimal total edge weight that separates E into E1. Separates the vertices into sets V1 and V2. There's a slight generalization of the min cut, which people prefer to talk about a little bit more, called ST cuts, which just involve taking some subset of the vertices, identifying them as the sources, some other set of the vertices, identifying them as the sinks, and finding the min cut that separates the sources from the sinks. So this gives you more flexibility because the vertices that are defined as neither sources nor sinks, they can be on either side of the cut. And so you have more choices. So this min cut is where, when you're talking about cuts, you need to start considering these capacities, because these capacities are also the edge weights that I was previously talking about. There's a theorem that called the max flow min cut theorem. Which just says that if I'm trying to maximize the flow between two sets of vertices, that is equivalent to minimizing the cut between the two sets of vertices. Actually, the first time this theorem was proven was when, I forget if it was the Germans or the Russians, I think it was the Russians. So the US was trying to figure out during the Cold War what the optimal way of bombing Russian train lines was in order to separate all supply flow from Eastern Russia to Western Russia. And the graph theorists that were studying this problem very quickly realized that the way of, that this is a cut problem, right? You're trying to cut all of the supply lines. That this cut problem was provably the same thing as what would happen if you most efficiently tried to send supplies in the most efficient way from one side to the other side. And so based on that, they proved this max flow min cut theorem that shows that these two things are equivalent.
Okay, I'm going to be super slow, but what, can you define a flow for me again?
Yeah, so a flow, let me give you a simple graph that has like a few different options. Let's say that this has capacity 2, this has capacity 1, this has capacity 5, and this has capacity 3. So if I'm trying to send a flow from point S to point T, then what is the maximum amount of flow that I can pipe here? Well, here I can send 2 units of flow this way, and then I saturate this. Let me switch these for a slightly less trivial example. I can send 2 units of flow this way, and then it doesn't matter that I have a bigger pipe here because I can't send more than 2 units of flow this way without bursting that pipe. And here I can send 5 units of flow this way, but it's not worth it to send more than 1 unit of flow this way because then I'll run into this thinner pipe.
So it's a single pass through there.
No, it's like a union of simultaneous paths through it. So here in this thing, I would want to send 2 units of flow this way and 1 unit of flow this way, right? So then the max flow here is 3, but then it's not difficult to convince yourself that the min cut here is to cut like that through the 2 edge and the 1 edge, and so the min cut is equal to the max flow. And this remains true for any graph that you can draw.
And not just 1 point to 1 point.
Not just 1 point to 1 point. This is true for both min cuts and ST cuts.
Does a cut have to include all the edges that come out of each of the vertices in the subset? Can it take a subset of that?
What do you mean by that? Sorry. Do you mean like the definition of an ST cut? So an ST cut is, I take the set of all vertices, and I partition them into the S vertices, and the T vertices, and then the rest of the vertices that I don't care which side of the cut they reside on. And then the ST cut is the min cut that partitions the S vertices from the T vertices. And then I don't care of the remaining vertices, they can be on either side.
That's not what I was asking.
Sorry, could you rephrase?
So a general graph has many edges at one at each vertex?
Yeah.
So when I define a cut, am I also selecting which of the edges at a given vertex the cut cuts? I always have to cut somehow all the edges, or
so
I don't quite know exactly what the definition.
So when you're defining a cut, you're ensuring that after you've made the cut, there does not exist any path from your left set of vertices to your right set of vertices. So for example, if I cut only this edge, then there would still be a path here. So this would not be considered like a complete cut. But I would need to cut either these two or these two, or I mean, the other different possibilities to have a way of partitioning this vertex from that vertex. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so it's really selection of edges that you pick, such that if you decompose the graph along those, you break all of those, then it falls apart.
That's right, then it breaks into the two pieces specified by the vertices. Okay, good. All right, so why do I care about this? Well, in some sense, holographic entanglement entropy is a statement about graphs, at least in the constant time case, but probably also in the covariant case in a way that's harder to formulate. Let's consider this thing. You guys have probably seen this. These are the RT surfaces associated with S of AB and S of BC. Right? So I can define a graph here by taking each of the bulk regions and associating a point with each of the bulk regions, and then defining an edge between any two points that are separated by at most one H, by exactly one HRT surface, or I guess in this case RT surface. So this graph would look like this, right? It is not difficult to convince yourself that this is a complete partitioning of the bulk. It's like a 0-1 bit string where you partition the entire bulk in this way. Thinking about things in this way, in this graph theoretic way, led to the work that we did in the this paper, the holographic entropy cone paper, where by thinking of the graph partitionings in this way, we found a new way of proving the holographic entanglement entropy inequalities that was more efficient than the previous ones, and in particular could be put on a computer and automated. And so by looking at it in this way, we found some infinite family of cyclic inequalities that are true for holographic states that obey the Ryutaki-Inagi formula at leading order. Right, so this is a way of just using the first part of the graph picture, taking the holographic space-time, or in particular the spatial slice, and partitioning it into regions, and then in an abstract sense, and using that to prove these entropy inequalities. So this is how you apply just the cut part of it, if you like. The HRT surfaces you should really think about as the cuts that that do things. Well, if these are cuts, then as Matt probably has said, the bit threads that he talks about are kind of like the flows. If you look through the original paper by Hedrick and Friedman, he goes through a great deal of detail to argue that the bit threads are related to the RT cuts by the max flow min cut theorem. This is why, like, the entanglement entropy across an RT surface, I guess he hasn't come out with the covariant thing yet, is given by maximizing the number of bit threads that you can pipe through it. It's like a maximization of the flow through that region. So this is basically applying MFMC plus the fact that RT is equivalent to a min cut. So what this is showing us is that there seems to be an interesting connection between techniques in discrete graph theory that one can use to study properties of the discrete graphs and properties of entanglement entropies. So far, in these cases, it's manifested as properties of holographic entanglement entropies. But what I'm going to argue, or try to argue to you, is that the connection between graph theory and generalizations thereof and quantum entropies in general, beyond the holographic limit, is something that actually persists. So at this point, before I start with that, are there other questions? Remember, feel free to ask as many as you want. All right, so at this point you might be a little confused as to why I'm saying this, because one of the things that we proved in the entropy cone paper is that the set of entanglement entropies, is that the set of entropies obeyed by holographic states is exactly the same as the set of entropies given by min cuts on undirected graphs. So how could it possibly be that cuts on graphs could be dual to things that are not holographic? So for example, a list of things that aren't holographic are the GHZ state, which looks like 0 tensor n plus 1 tensor n, or the W state, which looks like 1, 1, and the remainder zeros. It's not difficult to show that these states are inconsistent with the entropy inequalities that are obeyed by all holographic states. I think they both violate either MMI or the higher cyclic inequalities, depending on how big they are. Nevertheless, you might want to target these states. Like I was saying, you might be confused why the undirected graph cuts, why graph theory could possibly tell you more. And the insight, I think, that tells you why it can tell you more is that you want to generalize away from undirected graphs. So one thing that you can do is I can take the notion of edges as things that connect two points at a time, and I can generalize this to the notion of k edges that connect k points at a time. So these edges are also called hyperedges. And the graphs that are made out of, that are composed of hyperedges beyond two edges are called hypergraphs. So this also takes you from normal graphs to hypergraphs. Here's an example of a hyperedge. I can have, for example, four vertices and a single hyperedge connecting all of them. You should think of a hyperedge as like a bag that contains the vertices. Now I can ask, how do I cut a hyperedge? How do I partition one of the vertices that's within the hyperedge from the other three, or two of them from the other four? The answer to those in the context of a hyperedge is always the same. The only way that you can isolate these from the other ones is to cut the entire hyperedge completely. So if I imagine puncturing the bag, or like just eliminating the bag, then these four are no longer associated by each other, with each other by a k edge, and so they separate.
They could be connected by some other.
Yeah, sorry, I meant that the connections sourced by the k edges is removed, but indeed there could be other internal connections by two edges or other k edges. I just mean by the single specific k edge. Why is this interesting? Well, this is interesting at first glance because if I have, say, k vertices that are connected by a single k edge, and I demand that the entanglement entropy associated is still associated by min cuts here, then the minimum cut that will partition any subset of these edges, any subset of these vertices from their complement, is the same as any other one, right? You're always cutting the same object, so the cut that partitions two from the other two or one from the other three, as long as you're not doing the trivial partitioning, is always the same. So what does this mean? This means that all of the entanglement entropies of the subsystems are the same. And it's not difficult to convince yourself by looking at the GHZ state that this state has this property. If I trace out any of the subsystems and I calculate its entanglement entropy, they're all the same. Like, the one body, two body, three body, up to however much you want below the full system size, all of the entropies are the same. So what this means is that these min cuts on hypergraphs naturally encode the entanglement entropies associated with GHZ states on these single hyperedges. In fact, the most trivial instance of a hypergraph encodes those entanglement entropies. We can prove further things. So for hypergraphs, we can show that for four-party states, that we can figure out what inequalities are obeyed by these cut entropies on the hypergraphs. And we find that the hypergraph cone or, in other words, the allowed space in entropy space of states that are whose entropies can be represented by hypergraphs. We find that this hypergraph cone is equivalent to the stabilizer cone. Where the stabilizer cone maybe is familiar to you because These are things that are important in quantum error correction. You should think of stabilizer states as states that can be realized from the all zeros product state, acting only on it with controlled knots, phases, Hadamard gates, and measurements. So it's a restricted subset of all quantum states. You can prove that these two things are the same. And the way that you prove them is that the graph theoretic technique of proving the inequalities for the normal undirected graphs has a natural generalization to hypergraphs. And such that if you prove that some generalized version of the contraction property holds for hypergraphs, then those inequalities are correct. So you can prove this at four parties. Michael Walther and his student Freck proved that the hypergraph cone is contained, but it's unclear if it's properly contained by the stabilizer cone, meaning that they showed that for every hypergraph state, there exists a large N random tensor, random stabilizer tensor network instantiation of that hypergraph state, which shows that this cone is contained within this one. Now, it's tantalizing that we haven't yet figured out a way to do it, to see if we could find containment in the other direction. I guess that means that we don't know.
Large N, what do you mean by that?
So they use some bond dimension-like argument from Nozomi Walther to argue that, like, that the entanglement entropies of their random stabilizer tensor network are saturated in some appropriate way, to argue that if someone gives you a list of entropies consistent with the hypergraph cone, then you can always convert those into a specific large N random stabilizer state. If I gave you a small N stabilizer state, you might not saturate those Swingle limits. I think that's what they're called.
And so that's okay?
Yeah.
These
cones are linear, so if you can saturate them at some slice, then you can extrapolate back down to the origin.
So, yeah. First, could you define the stabilizer cone?
Yeah, so the stabilizer cone, so let me, I verbally define stabilizer states, but let me write it down again. It's the set of states reachable from a tensor product of the zero state, acting only on it with C-naught, Hadamard, and I think phase. Though, it's, and measurements. You should think of it as some restricted set of all quantum states. So because it's a restricted set of all quantum states, it'll obey additional inequality constraints, or it can and indeed does obey additional inequality constraints that generic quantum states do not necessarily obey.
What is C-naught in terms of Pauli matrices?
C-naught is 1, 1, 1, 1. So if the first qubit is a 1, if the first qubit is a 0, you do nothing. The second qubit is a 1. If the first qubit is a 1, you flip the second qubit.
And how big a subspace can you generate by acting on beats?
That's a tricky question. I'm not really sure how to answer that question.
Hadamard, is that acts on a single qubit?
Yeah, both of these act on single qubits. So if you like, this is the only one that can really change your entanglement structure.
I thought that the size of the stabilizer state is it's not exponential, right?
It probably is, I just don't know it all. Well, I don't know if it's...
They were sort of computationally feasible or something.
They are. They're like classically simulable, which probably means that they're fairly simple, but I don't know the sharp thing to tell you, so I don't want to say a wrong thing. Sorry, Shi?
What party states? Do you mean mixed states or pure states?
I mean four-party mixed states. Yeah, so there's this extra Ingleton inequality that's true for stabilizer states that's enters at four-party mixed. I think for three-party mixed, the quantum cone is the same as the stabilizer cone is, yeah. And then for four parties, there's this additional inequality.
And for when you say hypergraph cone, you're allowing all k edges for all k, is that correct?
That's right.
Do you get different results if you only include up to 10 edges, for
example? Yeah, you should. There's a conjecture that's in the paper that we weren't able to prove, which is that if you are interested in an n-party state like us, then you shouldn't require internal k edges of greater than n plus 1. Because you might think that if I'm trying to build entanglement of a certain type, I shouldn't need to take a detour into some much more complex entanglement structure before coming back down to this smaller thing. Interestingly, we couldn't prove that, but we could prove a polynomial limit on the k edge limit in the inside. So it would be nice to tighten that proof to the point where you only need to consider down to this kind of physically intuitive amount of graphs that you have on the inside. We weren't quite able to do that. Yeah?
Coming back, why is it called a stabilizer state? There must be another property that I'm missing that these states have.
Yeah, so they have some nice error correcting properties, which I think is where the name originally comes from. Yeah, of the Clifford operators, I think. But yeah, I mean, it's been a while since I've thought about stabilizer states, so I don't.
Okay, the thing is, I don't actually really know what the hypergraph cone is. I mean, the problem is, in the example you gave, mm-hmm. holographic entanglement, for example, you have to choose A, B, and C, which are some subspaces, over space or factors, mm-hmm. and then you get a graph. But
you can do the same thing here.
So what is it that you assign? So given a quantum system or Hilbert space and a decomposition of it into tensor factors, you then have a hypergraph cone of states or something. I just don't quite see how we're associating.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't—it's in some sense not as easy as in holography, where you can just pick boundary subregions and those give you your factorizations. Here, think about a system of a finite number of qubits, just for simplicity. I'll label some of those the A subsystem of qubits, some of those the B, some of those the C, etc. So, once you have something like that, then you can, and if that state happens to have entropies that are reproducible by these hypergraphs, then you have the decomposition.
Okay. So the decomposition is sort of part of the whole story. You fix that first, and then you talk about the graph.
That's right. Well, I guess the idea is that there could exist a graph that is consistent with many different decompositions, where I label the vertices, and then I just pick subsets of vertices to calculate the entanglement entropies. Right, that's the same thing that happens in holography, right? In holography, you could have said the same story where you say that you fixed these boundary subregions and you found a partitioning of the space-time that's consistent with them. But I don't change my space-time to fit my partitioning of boundary subregions. Rather, what I do is I change my partitioning of the space-time. So,
yeah, but then in the case of the hypergraph cone, are you thinking of each vertex as one qubit or something?
Yeah, so in a limit, in the extreme limit, you would think about each vertex as a single qubit, but you can kind of think about them as blocked up subsystems in, for example, these large n limits. So the idea is that here is another situation where we can use graph theoretic technology to take something that's generically very hard for quantum states, in particular calculating entanglement entropies, and convert it into some tractable graph theoretic problem that also lets us relatively efficiently determine the bounds and certain properties of these things. Good? All right. So I would really like to know the answer to this question, so if anyone has ideas on this, that would be great. Basically, what it would correspond to is taking any stabilizer state and showing that its entropies can be represented as cuts on the hypergraph. It would be interesting if you could find a dictionary between the hypergraph operations and the stabilizer operations. For example, what does C not do? What do generalizations of C not do? What do these other things do to the graph? Because if you found a one-to-one dictionary between those two things, then you would succeed in showing kind of both of these at the same time. We have not yet found that, but it's a question I'm interested in asking about. Yeah?
Do you know of a simplest state that is not in a stabilizer cone?
Yeah, that one. W is not in the stabilizer cone. And you can prove that you can't make it using hypergraphs. So you might think, oh, well, big deal. In some sense, you only found kind of one new class of state. So that's why I want to move to the next part of my talk, which is telling you how to generalize it yet further to get the W state and, super ambitiously speaking, possibly any quantum state. So let's consider the four-party stabilizer state again. So here we know that S of anything is equal to 1 if this edge weight is 1, right? Interestingly, there's an equivalent way of computing min cuts of this hypergraph by considering min cuts of a directed graph. Directed graph, not a directed hypergraph. So here's what you do. You consider two vertices, E1 and E2, that are internal vertices, so you don't consider those as partitions. Then you consider your A, B, C, and D like this. There's one edge from E1 to E2, that's weight 1, and then all of the others are connected in this directed way. So now you have a directed graph like this, right? Now the question of how much flow I can send from one vertex to a complement of other vertices changes a little bit because now there's a directionality. If the arrow goes this way, I can't send flow that way, right? So you can see how this is a more constrained problem than the undirected graph problem. Now what happens here is that in order to reproduce that, I simply set all of the other edge weights that aren't the one that's labeled 1 to infinite edge weight. So what that does is that makes it so that if the min cut can choose to not cut it, it will not cut it. It kind of, basically what that does is it routes all of the min cuts through here. And actually you can see that if I cut this one edge, I've actually partitioned any subset from any other subset. Because if I cut this one edge, all of the flow from A, for example, goes to E2, but then the only arrows at E2 are inward directed, so there's nowhere else for the flow to go, right? The only outward directed flow from E2 was the flow from E2 to E1. So if I cut this, then I've partitioned A from B, C, D. And similarly, I've partitioned A and B from C and D and all of the other things. So you can show that by taking hyperedges and blowing them up in this way to a directed graph edge, you can reproduce the min cuts associated with the hyper edge. So this gets you GHZ, but notice that I said that I took all of these other edge weights to infinity. This naturally motivates the question of what happens if I relax that. What happens if I take the edge weights of all of the other ones except this one away from infinity and down to some finite value? Well, if I take them down first, when I bring them down from infinity, nothing happens. If I make them all like 100 or something, I'll still prefer to cut this. But eventually what will happen is that once I make cutting these other edges, for example, cutting these two edges competitive with cutting that edge for separating one from the other things, then I'll start to see different behaviors in the entanglement. So just for simplicity, let me say that all of these edges are weight x. So everything except for this edge is weight x. So in the situation where x starts to become less than or equal to 1/2. Now all of the one-body entropies become 2x. So S of the one-body terms becomes 2x here, because you prefer to cut these two instead of cutting this if x is less than or equal to 1/2. And then S of the two-body terms if x is greater than or equal to 1/4, it's still going to be equal to 1. So what this gives you is this gives you a freedom to set the ratio between the one-body terms and the two-body terms. And that actually, that freedom is enough to allow you to reconstruct the entropies of the W state. So in some sense, there's a kind of interesting phase transition here, where if I plot S a function of x, S of 2 over S of 1, I know that at large n, at x greater than 1/2, it's just equal to 1. And then somewhere between 1 and 2, go like this until 1/4. Then it'll flatten out. And then somewhere here is the W state. This range, wherever you want, this is where the GHZ state lives. And you can show that once these edge weights become so small that you would never choose to cut this one, you would always choose to cut the lower ones, then you get that the S of the two-body entropy is just equal to twice the one-body entropy. And then this state becomes consistent with a perfect tensor. So down here, we have the perfect tensor, the perfect tensor state for the four-party pure state. So this is an interesting thing because it somehow says that there's one controllable parameter in these graphs that if I tune them, I can reproduce maybe the entanglement entropies of differing types of states that aren't interconvertible using distillation operations. So this is interesting to me anyway.
So something I'm really not following is,
yeah,
I sort of see what you're talking about, getting this graph from that, I mean this plot from that graph.
Yeah.
But I don't see what quantum state that graph necessarily represents, or even that there exists one. I mean, you're speaking as if you're identifying certain points on that curve with specific quantum state.
Mm-hmm.
Is every point on the curve associated with a quantum state, and is that obvious?
Yes, I think so. And so I think that the...
So I'm just missing the... There's an obvious map that you're thinking of.
Yeah, so...
I don't see that maps this graph to a... quantum states
are
a class of
them. So the question of how to map quantum states to directed graphs in general, for more complicated directed graphs, that question in general I don't know how to answer. But for this question, I feel like I can maybe do some simple like linear interpolation. So I can find a state that's an epsilon, that's like a superposition between a GHZ state and a W state. And as I tune that parameter, the relative weight between the GHZ state and the W state, that should push me up this trajectory. But like a full systematic understanding of the kinds of quantum states that are associated with these directed graphs, we don't yet know. This is actually what we're working on now. But I think that something will emerge that we're just in the process of trying to find out. Did you have a question? Okay. Okay, so now what I want to talk about is like kind of the relative containment of these things. So we saw that for undirected graphs, the set of entropies that you can represent with undirected graphs is contained in the set of graphs, in the sum set of states that you can represent with undirected hypergraphs, and that is contained within the set of states that you can represent with directed graphs. There's a potential further extension that we haven't done, which is to talk about directed hypergraphs. You might wonder, how do you assign direction to hyperedges? But one way, for example, is to use generalizations of the Levi-Civita tensor, where like the permutations give you some sort of thing, or to use the holicity, formalism that the amplitudes people talk about, but those are just ideas, not sure how they work. What we seem to be finding, though, and this is a proposal, is that there is a duality between the type of graph that you're considering and the type of state that you're considering. So for the undirected graphs, it's easy to show that these are related to the holographic states, because the undirected graphs can just be thought of as simple partitionings of the bulk spacetime. For the undirected hypergraphs, there's evidence, though we don't yet have a complete proof, that these correlate to the stabilizer states. And for the directed graphs, we don't really know what kinds of states that they correspond to. We know that they correspond to stabilizers. We know that they can do stabilizer states because stabilizer states you can do with hypergraphs. And we know that they can do the W state, which is not a stabilizer state. So ambitiously, one might ask the question, and this is very much a question. I guess this is just one question mark worth of question, as to whether directed graphs are dual to the set of all quantum states. And this question, trying to check this question is not as impossible as it might seem at first. There has been work done, for example, at four parties. So at four parties, it's known that the quantum cone is strictly contained. By the cone that's just bounded by permutations of Strong Sub additivity. And indeed, there are two families of extremal rays, lists of entropies, that of the SSA cone that provably cannot be represented by any quantum state. There is also a candidate inequality that cuts off those two families of extremal rays and then generates other extremal rays that may or may not be realizable by quantum states. We don't yet know. Called the Jang-Yung inequality. And using a generalization of the contraction map method that now works for directed graphs, we can prove that the Jang-Yung inequality is obeyed by all cut entropies of directed graphs. So we know at the very least we've excluded the two provably unconstructible extremal ray families. Extreme ray families of the strong subadditivity cone.
I guess I missed something about the relation. So hypergraphs, directed graphs, you mean just graphs not directed, like they're not hypergraphs, they only have two vertex lengths.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, and you know some quantum states are well described by undirected hypergraphs.
Yeah.
Yet you think they also may be discardable by directed graphs that are not hypergraphs.
Yeah, I mean, that prescription, if I do it for every single hyperedge, will generate a directed graph whose min cuts are the same as the min cuts of the hypergraph.
I guess I missed that prescription, sorry.
Yeah, so if I take a k-edge, if I take one specific hyperedge, and I blow it up in this way, meaning I introduce two internal points with an edge connecting the two of them, and then introduce these loops, like I have four loops here, one corresponding to each of the boundary ones. I can have k of them, nothing really changes. So if for every hyper edge I do that,
you add vertices and represent a k edge by a bunch of edges, directed edges.
That's right. There's an algorithmic way of doing it, so it must work. The reason why the containment probably happens is that when you add the direction information, you make the problem much more constrained, and so you make it much richer. And so in particular, when you're finding the minimum, unlike with undirected either one, where you just find the absolute minimum, now the absolute naive minimum that you see by eye is not necessarily the true minimum, and so you can attain richer structures. Of course, I can reproduce any undirected graph just by taking every pair of vertices and having an arrow going both ways, both the same weight. Mm-hmm. And so it's clear that that contains the first one. But now it's also clear that it contains the second. So some stuff that we're interested in thinking about here is can we find the extremal rays, the extreme rays of the SSA cone plus the inequalities that we can prove are true for these directed graph cases? And can we find a directed graph instantiation that reproduces all of those extreme rays with their cuts? And then secondly, can we also find a quantum state instantiation that reproduces that list of entropies? If we can find both of those things, then we'll prove at least at four parties that the directed graph cone is a subset of the set of all quantum states. It's more difficult to prove the other way, that any quantum state's entropies can be represented by directed graphs, because once you have just quantum states, you lose a lot of the structure that allowed you to attack the problem earlier. But it remains a tantalizing possibility. I like this story because it kind of tells me that this graph theoretic or geometrizing approach towards holographic entanglement entropy maybe can extend away from the holographic limit. It's telling me that states that in principle have nothing to do with holography, like the GHC state and the W states and other generalizations thereof, seemingly I can attack with the same graph theoretic techniques. And I wonder what kinds of other constraints thinking about things in this way will let me further pursue. Are there any other questions? Is there something specific?
Is there some way to go from this to a tensor network or something? Given one of these graphs,
yeah, that's what Michael and for holographic states, that's what Michael and Sepper did. Mm-hmm. Their random tensor network construction to realize RT is a tensor network instantiation of graphs. And then in his follow-up paper, this one with his student Freck, he found a random stabilizer state tensor network instantiation of the hypergraph cone. So I guess it's possible that you could find a tensor network instantiation of the directed graph cone. The one thing that's a little less clear to me is actually what is the correct quantum interpretation of these directions? Because for the undirected graphs, those seem fine. They're just some tensor network construction. But what does it mean if I have an edge going from one vertex to the other vertex and not the other way? It seems that is asking for an interpretation that doesn't currently exist using quantum states. So I think trying to understand this reverse direction and the tensor network question, which I guess is similar, require some understanding of what these directions actually mean, other than just a way of breaking symmetry.
When you define the flow for a directed graph,
yeah,
if a cut goes through, I'm trying to reconcile the embedding the undirected graphs in the directed one.
Yeah. Right. So
if a cut goes through both directions of a given edge.
Yeah.
I guess I don't want to count them as negatives of each other because the flows will cancel. So what's the rule for assigning?
Good. So what you do is you get a generalization away from V and E to V E left and E right. So those edges, if I have the bidirectional things, the ones that go from left to right for some vertex set will belong to this one, and the ones that go from left to right will belong to this one. And if I'm ever computing something like a source sink cut or a min cut, I pretend that some set of vertices are where the water is coming from and the other set are where the water is going to. And I'm asking the question of, like, how much water can I pipe going from this way to that way? And so in that question, I can ignore all of the edges that are irrelevant. That would be part of the second one.
The notion of a cut is a little bit different. You get to choose.
Yeah. Actually, all of these MFMC type theorems were originally proven for directed graphs, and they're true for undirected graphs as a corollary. So in some sense, you should think of the undirected case as a specialization of the MFMC theorem instead of the other way being a generalization. No, but it's seeming likely.
So neither side is going to be contained in the other.
Well, we know that the directed graph cone actually obeys an inequality that's stronger than the Zhang-Yung inequality. And we know that the Zhang-Yung inequality slices off these two extreme ray families that Linden and Winter proved are not constructible by any quantum state. So now we have a new set of extreme rays that we need to simply ask, can we construct a quantum state that satisfies, that reconstructs this list of entropies? And because we've sliced off the ones that were in some sense the most offensive things that kept you outside the quantum cone, it's now more likely that we're inside the quantum cone, but that's a check that we need to do to see whether or not these extreme rays can actually be realized by quantum states.
Sorry, I don't quite understand that. The inequality is
It is not known if it's generally true for all quantum states. So far, no one has found a counterexample quantum state that does not obey this inequality. So I think that if I had to place bets, though I don't know why I would do such a thing, I would say that the directed graph cone is most likely to be a proper subset of the quantum cone. An interesting proper subset. Then after that, it is the next most likely thing is that it's actually exactly equal to the quantum cone, and the least likely thing is that it's strictly bigger than the quantum cone. Though, I mean, the ratio of these distributions could have some exponential fall off. So
suppose I start with one qubit. Okay, I think we know the full answer there. Mm-hmm. So I start increasing the number of qubits.
Yeah.
Up to what number is the answer known?
For quantum, 3.
What, pardon?
3.
So for 3, are the direct graph?
Yeah, they're the same.
They're the same. Right, yeah. So then for 4, it's not known, is that the case?
That's right.
Right, so what I wanted to ask was, how amenable to, like, computer analysis is the problem? Can we generate random states, choose number, and just do some diagnostic and explore it experimentally?
Right, so there are 3 things that I want to say to that. The first is, not only can you generate random states, you can also generate random graphs. So, like, depending on which one is more amenable to the technology that you have. So certainly you can do that. The second thing is kind of a word of caution. So one of the problems is that random states are not very typical with respect to, like, holography, for example. So their properties are very special. If I have a state that's truly random, then it'll start taking on properties associated with the Haar distribution. And so then, like, entanglement entropies of subsystems are, like, very close to being maximally mixed if they're small enough. And so in that sense, if I'm really generating samples like that, then I'm likely to oversample from certain parts of the entropy distribution and undersample from others.
Okay, but we're not asking a statistical question. We just want to know, is every single quantum state of, say, 4 qubits realizable as a directed graph? Are its entropies realizable by it?
I guess I don't understand how to answer that question with computer analysis in a non-statistical way. Like, there's no systematic way of writing down every four-qubit state, unless you mean I'm allowing all of the amplitudes to be variable.
I don't need to write them all, but I mean, like, pick one, you know, do it one at a time. Pick one, find all of its entropies.
Yeah.
And explore all the possible graphs in some algorithm.
Yes.
Try to construct one that matches that state.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're done, okay, then you show at least that state is there.
Yeah, so that you can certainly, right, so that you can certainly do. The thing that I'm not sure about is how to, like, eventually my imagination will run dry and I need to find some algorithmic way of generating the other states. And that is the thing that I'm not sure how to automate without oversampling from random states. Because, like, the most straightforward way to think about doing it is to do a Monte Carlo generate, like, a bunch of states where you just have, like, random coefficients for the pure state. That will oversample. And so then the question is there a different, still randomized, is there a different algorithm that's, like, not, that will not take you to, like, the Haar sector immediately, that samples more evenly? Now, having said that, the third thing that I was going to say is even though you wildly oversample, if you take the randomized distribution, if you sample from like a large enough set of things, then eventually you will still, hit the tails, if you like, if the tails are not so small. And for like small numbers of qubits, that might be fine. Like the Haar distribution is really a problem if you're trying to randomly generate things of like 50 or 60 qubits, then subsystems that are 15 or 16 qubits are like 1 over 2 to the 10 close and trace distance to the maximally mixed state, which is not something that you want. But if I have like a 4-qubit system, then it's maybe still possible. The tails are pretty fat. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's an interesting thing to try to do. Okay, thank you. Yeah, probably. My sense is that the exact same proof for polyhedrality for the other two will also work here.
But is it expected that quantum cone is not a polyhedral?
I think that's open, right? I think the classical cone is known to not be polyhedral, but the quantum cone, I think it is unknown if it's polyhedral or not. Yeah.
The possibility that a quantum cone is also polyhedral.
Yeah, that's right. But remember I said that was the second of my likelihood things, and the likelihood could go from something like 99% to 0.9% to just an indescribably small percentage. So, I mean, you have to do your weighting correctly, I guess.
Is there something else that you can do that's bigger?
Yeah, so you can do directed hypergraph cones. I would need to figure out how to consistently define things in terms of helicity, but the amplitudes people do this, right? So like they define an order for vertices that are not necessarily planar. And so something like that is in principle possible. For example, if I only had up to 3 edges, I might say that things that were positive with the Levi-Civita tensor are ordered correctly, and things that are negative are not, and things that I could define some sort of order in that sort of generalized way. I'm hoping to not have to go there, because once I go there, then the number of choices that I have to make, I think, explodes. Like, my prescription on how to define an order is combinatorially large. And so I would be happier if it kind of ended here. Yeah, they obey max cut min flow. There's something called something called the Menger property, but it's the same thing.
And the rule is that when you define a flow, it's still normal. How do I think about the flow on
a hyper edge is still a limit of capacity,
okay.
Right? Yeah. It's just kind of like a, you should think of it about it this way. I am now no longer capable of sending stuff to both Ted and Tom without sending stuff to both Ted and Tom. I can't send it to them separately. That's like what a hyper edge does for capacity. Whereas if there was a single directed edge, I could either turn the one to you on and the one to you off or vice versa. But you can't do that for a hyper edge. Yeah. Good. I think that's like the cross-sectional area of the piece of the RT surface you have. So like, if you like, what is the maximum number of bit threads I can pipe through A? That's going to be the area of the RT surface because the bit threads have Planckian spacing.
Questions?